You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions. Welcome, everyone, to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 161. I'm your temporary, sometimes co-host, Chris Webster, and on today's show, we are going to talk about something called decolonization. We had a guest scheduled for today, but as those things do sometimes, it didn't pan out, so we're going to get them rescheduled, and now you're stuck with me. So I'm going to talk about this with Alan. He brought the topic to the table, and we put this together in the last few days here. Alan, why don't you bring us into the topic?
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land and on the Rock Art Podcast. This has been something that's been sitting with me for quite a while now. And Given our international platform, I kept hearing about this particular aspect of conducting rock art research and the critical need for such a perspective. If I tried to define this decolonization or decolonialization, what's been happening with the archaeological profession, as you're well aware, Chris, is we've been met with native people who are now becoming far more powerful, connected politically, intellectually, legally, and have a lot to say about how we do archaeology or rock art studies. And that's a wake-up call, I think, to those of us who maybe have not embraced such a perspective. Do you agree or not?
No, I do agree. Let's try to define this term for our audience, just so people understand exactly what we're talking about. Yeah,
absolutely. It's an odd term. It's one that I hadn't even used before, but I partnered with a gentleman who has been on our show, I think, only once, and his name is Jose Botello, and he just got his master's degree out at California State University, Northridge, and it was an autobiographical portrait of his experiences in his pueblo from Mexico and where he participated in ceremonial activities that were syncretic between the Catholic religion and the native, call it Aztec or Nahua religion. Okay. Interesting. And he learned both dancing and some other theatrics that went along with it. And this was an interesting parlay. So now, when I have been working on my own research, this book, trying to fast forward in my own research in the Cosos, I found it necessary to see if I could partner with someone like Jose, who understands the ancient or archaic Udo-Aztecan perspectives and understands both Nahuatl and the religious metaphors that go along with the understanding of these, what we would call supramundane beings, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Okay. And I have about maybe, let's say, 70% of this book written, and I had him review it. It's going to be about 100 pages long. And he came back with about a 50-page review. And I was shocked. You know, I thought I was doing a good job. And he told me in no uncertain terms that I had missed the boat. And I said, how have I missed the boat? The first thing I missed the boat about is that when you're talking about indigenous groups, ethnic units, ethnolinguistic entities, we often or almost always use the Euro-American term for them. So they're called Serrano, or they're called Kawayasu, or they're called Coso or Panamint Shoshone. Those aren't the names they use for themselves, not at all. And so that's found to be offensive and a step in the wrong direction if you're going to try to integrate or bring in a voice, a perspective, a knowledgeable insider view of what the research is that you're doing. Have you run across that or no?
Yeah. And in a lot of cases in the West, specifically, I would say Nevada and California, we often have Native American monitors on site, not only just monitors, sometimes just literally doing survey with us so they can help bring that interpretation, not just our textbook interpretations of things, because archaeologists are pretty good about describing things, but we don't necessarily know what it means. You know what I mean? I can give you the dimensions of something, but do I know anything else about it culturally? In some cases, maybe because we've studied, but it's best to have that perspective. And I can think of one particular time we were doing this project up in Northern California, and the person who runs the company actually brought a guy in from the local tribe to talk about some of the unique types of artifacts we might find on this site, because it's a unique, somewhat a unique area, and they had some interesting cultural things, and he just wanted to bring that Native American perspective in there and say, here's the kind of things you might find, here's what they actually mean, here's the context they would be found in, things like that. And it just really helped us with that perspective, because it's not a perspective that we have. We have to ask the questions.
So if you can imagine moving from the physical objects or the conventional things we do in archaeological research, subsistence, mm-hmm. settlement, technology, to the highly theoretical and in some cases, what would you call it, mystical boundaries of the religious metaphors of these groups, we're working in a whole different world, are we not?
Mm-hmm. For sure.
So to garner that perspective on these rather esoteric elements would be invaluable. And so yeah. That's what I've done with Jose, brought him on board, and he's going to be a co-author of this book. And also, I'm going to try to respond to all of his suggestions as best I can. So mm-hmm. The first realm was, of course, the verbiage. So what do you call these people? Use the names that they call themselves. So you're not going to call them Kawaiasu. You're going to call them Nuwa or Nu'ua, which just means person. It's Numic. Or if you're going to call the Hopi, you don't call them Hopi. You call them Moki. You right. call them by the name that would be their self-identifier in their own language. The next thing that they want us to do is to not compartmentalize things in such a, how would you put it, Eurocentric way or Cartesian way of thinking. We like to put things in boxes or right. classify them and say, okay, this is a gendered depiction of a Coatlicue analog. That would be the animal, the bird animal person that is huge in indigenous cosmology for the Aztec or Nahua people. When you see such a statue, this Coatlicue statue is like 25 tons, sits in the, you know, in Mexico City. It's considered to be the mother. It's got breasts. It's of the eagle, and there's eagle feathers and avian legs on this particular sculpture. So what Jose told me was, no, you shouldn't think about classification so much or even gender so much. What you have to think about is the meaning, the purpose, the activities surrounding them, the almost the psychological elements that go into an understanding of the kind of aspects of the tropes, the elements that we've got mm. here. So when I talked about Coatlicue, he said, you think about this being, first of all, it's not necessarily definitively always a female. It has male elements to it. It's this binary opposition is not so important to the Nahua people, but it's a nurturing phenomenon that it deals with both death and life. The yeah. death side is covered with skulls all over this particular, and it's rather scary to look at in some ways, but it goes to the heart and soul of things that we may not understand or think about very much. And that is to sustain life when you're dealing with the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
You have to kill to live. You have sure. to kill animals, right? You have yeah. to harvest plants. And so there is this binary opposition constantly going on psychologically. You are dealing with a means of trying to extract energy and sustenance from the natural environment while having to destroy it at the same time. So it's a destruction and creation. And I know that's a little deep and crazy and twisted, but that is the kind of deep-seated psychological kinds of stuff that this religion, this philosophy, this architecture of ceremonialism was all about. And you could tell that, my word, when you talk about the Aztecs. It was a very violent culture in a lot of ways, but in a lot of ways also, it was one that was very uplifting and had tremendous elements to it that were beautiful and enriching and motherly, etc. So at the same time, you have to deal with both sides of that coin. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. All right. I think that's a good place to take a break because I've definitely got some thoughts on that.
Good.
And we will talk about that on the other side back in a minute. Welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 161. This is Chris Webster. I'm here with Dr. Alan Garfinkel, and we're talking about decolonization or decolonialization, depending on how you want to pronounce that. And I just was thinking that people may still be having a hard time understanding what this really means and how to apply this. And I'm currently on a drive across the country, and not to get too deep into it, but we have this membership where we can stay at museums and wineries and things like that. You basically stay for free, but you patronize the business. And we happen to be in Midland, Texas for the night. And I'm sitting in the parking lot of the Permian Basin Petroleum Museum. And yeah, we went through it when we got here for about an hour and a half or so before they closed. And it's one of those things where if you want to understand what this is all about, in order to discuss something, you have to know how to speak the language. And driving down Interstate 20 between Midland and Odessa, literally right smack in the middle of the Permian Basin, you're seeing all these, a lot of people might know the term oil derrick, those bobby up and down things that are pumping oil out of the ground. And then you see the oil drills, and there's just a whole bunch of stuff that you have no idea what those that stuff is. And not that I'm an expert now anyway, but going through that museum helped me, I think, form some of the vocabulary that I just never had. You see these things on TV, you see them driving down the road sometimes. It's just, you can't even discuss it with somebody who works in this field unless you have a shared vocabulary. And
yeah, exactly right.
Yeah. And I think it goes to this with any Native American studies or Native anybody studies, is having that shared understanding and vocabulary.
So as an anecdote, I remember on the biggest project of our life, my lifetime, second biggest one, we had a group of archaeologists that were asked to do an additional survey over this area that was connected to the project footprint. And so the two of them went out, and they were told that they were going to be tangentially on an Indian allotment, but they went ahead and went over the particular barriers that were there, where there weren't many, and began to walk back and forth. There's an Indian sitting there on her property. Do you think they would stop and ask them or socialize or talk with them a bit before they began to do their shtick? No, right. No. What is it about these people? Are they afraid of talking to other people? Are they somehow intimidated by Native Americans? What's going on here? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
You've run across this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Especially with
archaeologists. We come out of school and we read in textbooks, and let me not dismiss any of that either at the same time, because there are actually several valid perspectives on the archaeological record, on history, on prehistory,
sure,
right?
Of course.
Now, Native Americans might not look at typologies. They may not look at putting things in boxes, but sometimes putting things in boxes does give you somewhat of a frame of reference for something, but it doesn't give you 100% of the picture. And on the flip side, Native Americans today may not even have 100% of the picture. And in fact, they probably don't, of something that happened 1,000 years ago. They have this ancestral knowledge because a lot of things have been passed down, and they have current practices that are doing that mirror some things that are in the past. So they have that knowledge, but they also might not have the complete picture. And I think when you bring both of these together, you start building a bigger picture of what was actually going on in the past at different time periods. And I think
absolutely.
There's validity on both sides.
I think there's validity on both sides, but yeah. I do think, especially dealing with the subject matter that I have to deal with when I'm looking at the images on stone that are obviously related to symbolism and religious metaphor.
Yeah.
I want to give you some of the terminology that was used by Jose, because it is so deep and so metaphoric and so visual in some ways. What he talks about when he talks about talking about some of these deities or some of these active super mundane beings or elements. What we're talking about, he doesn't like the term goddesses, doesn't like the term gods. He says that that really the Uto-Aztecan cosmology, you can't even talk to him about Mother Earth or celestial goddesses like analogs. Those are all Western concepts. What he talks about is energy. He talks about mothering. He talks about these connections of personalities that are really above nature, intervening in the world from outside. They're not separate beings who own the forces they express. They gather up these forces and use them for the goodness of the people. They talk about vortexes, and they talk about energy. They talk about movement. They talk about love and the way in which this mothering effect can bless the people. It's a cosmic process. And even she or he is not something that they necessarily have to have a division on, because often, and I come to understand this, in Nahua or Aztec cosmology, really didn't matter that much. A particular god or goddess could have both male and female aspects to their singular nature. And just like with Catholicism, we have a god that's three in one. Yeah, how the exactly. heck is that? How could it be three in one? It's a mystery. Right? One of those
because
mysteries,
it is.
Right? Yes. And so they're talking about keeping the world in equilibrium with this tableau of different characters. They're talking about these animal-human hybrids as personifications that are different separate entities, but yet they're important to them, not by their names per se, but in what they do, how they affect the order of life, and how they can right. assist the people in garnering longevity, successful births, things along those lines that just were rather important to Native people and to people still to this very day.
And
go ahead.
Just a thought, because to go back to segment one, bringing yes. in Jose to talk about these perspectives that they have today, basically,
right.
and how you interpret your rock art. It made me think when you first started talking about this and start talking about in segment two here, interpreting symbols on rock art and just what you're seeing. It's interesting to me how stuff like that develops, right? Because when you go way far back in time in North America, you see incredibly abstract symbology, right? Or at least what right. appears to be abstract symbology, because we can't tell what it is, right? We look at it and we're like, I don't know what those lines mean, or those swivels or circles or whatever, right? But when you get later in time, you do end up seeing things that's clearly a snake, that's clearly a person, that's clearly a sun, that's clearly a whatever, right? And it makes me wonder the development of that and how current Native American groups think about this symbology, because as you go even much later to the contact period, you start seeing things like cowboy hats and soldiers right. and right. literal representations of things that they're seeing, which makes me wonder how literal the representations are back into the past versus theoretical and abstract and religious by nature. It just, if there was a shift from abstract religious symbology to more literal representation, when did that happen? And did that ever happen? Or has it always been, hey, this is what I see and how I interpret how to draw it. And their drawing skill, their etching rock art skills just grew over time. I have no idea. Just things I'm thinking about while you're talking about this.
The earliest rock art we have, right? Paintings. Yeah. Believe it or not, and I think it's in there in Indonesia, mm-hmm. it's a representational image of an animal.
There you go. Yeah.
Now that's interesting, because when you look at North America rock art, from my understanding, cross-culturally, and there's books out on this, it was abstract at the base, and only as it emerged later in time, became more naturalistic and representational. And you're exactly right. It has a basal antiquity of these rather simplistic and abstract design motifs that we would have a hell of a time trying to understand.
Which is interesting in and of itself, because rock art goes back tens of thousands of years. And when you look at the people, let's talk about current theories of the peopling of the Americas, right?
Sure.
We go back 14, 15,000 years with really good hard evidence. We go back 20, 25,000 years with less good evidence, but still there. It's did people who came here, because Native Americans that are here, despite what some of their cosmologies might tell them, did not spring up in North America. This wasn't an independent birth of the human species. So they came here from somewhere else, regardless of how they got here. Did they lose that knowledge of the developing rock art that was really all around Europe and Asia at the time when they probably would have come over, their ancestors? Did they lose that sort of ability for several thousand years, or maybe had nowhere to do it or just didn't want to create rock art and then started over almost with more abstract relationships when people started doing rock art again, say in different parts of North America? I always wonder about that. Where did that development
shift? It really is a very mysterious sort of transition. And not to get off topic, but there is a book that was written just exactly about that and was done by a couple of my colleagues. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, and they have this huge book. It's very beautiful and a lot of pictures and everything else, and the pictures are eye candy, and the verbiage is good. But after I read the book back and forth and even looked for, I felt unsettled because I don't think it gave me an answer to that question that you and I have. How did this originate? Why was it so different? How does it come about? And that's exactly right. Now, that wouldn't bother our Native American friends. It wouldn't bother our friend Jose, because when they look at some of these images, they see motion, they see light, they see water, they see blood, they see breath. And even some of these very basic images are exactly a combination of cosmic energy that they're looking at and talking about the connections of motion and energy and life all emitting into a single symbol. How about that? So you get a very complex set of metaphors coming about for something that seems very simple, right? So there's a thing called the Nahui Olin, which is their version of the encircled cross. And that encircled cross has more metaphors and meanings than you can shake a stick at. We had a whole hour-long talk just about the encircled cross. Was one of our podcasts. Remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, and so it has to do with the cardinal directions, the four sort of chapters of a living being. It has to do with resurrection, because you see that if you're looking at the cosmos and you're checking out the dawning star, and it goes away and then comes back all again, it is Venus, and that's considered to be the meaning of that symbol as well, and a resurrection, a nighttime resurrection and a rebirth of that same star, which is emblazoned in that particular symbol. So it's one that, in general, when we talk about trying to translate the passions and the metaphors, the meanings and the power and the glory embedded in all of these images, you can only get that, I think, if you were raised in this culture, right? Yeah. And then and this is going to take me in a sort of a right-hand turn, but it's important, that almost without exception, all over the world, the native people used an ethnogen, some sort of either a psychotropic plant or some other means of garnering non-ordinary reality. And so they could then, once they've captured that and understand the cosmic nature of the universe, that helps them get a guardian, and then they have this supernatural basis and a confidence that they would not have if they didn't have that experience. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah, I do. Let's go ahead and take a break, and we'll wrap this up with that. We'll start that discussion on the other side. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 161. We're talking about decolonization, and we're going to try to wrap all this up in the last segment here in solve all the world's problems. Alan,
put a bow. We're gonna yeah. put a bow on it. I think what I'm trying to say is, first of all, to go back to the very start of this, if you want to do good research and you want it to be accepted by others, you're going to have to open up your mind and somehow entertain the notion that there's totally other ways of thinking about this material culture. Mm-hmm. Totally different. Not non-Cartesian, non-linear. And it opens up an entire different way of understanding the world. It has to do with circuits and connections and supernatural beings and no distinctions that are black or white, but they're always in the gray or have other ways of doing things. It has to do with really capturing the buzz of the universe and the way in which we can understand the cycles, the power, the wind, the rain, the mountains, everything alive, and even everything that we think is, let's say, non-animism, okay? That is mm-hmm. not, that doesn't have agency or life, because as a native person, everything has life, every single thing.
Yeah.
And it's all part of this glorious whole that the physicists are beginning to show us, that everything has agency, connections, it makes decisions, and even those things that we think are not conventional, not alive, have life in them in some way or other. You understand?
Yeah, for sure. That's a perspective that a lot of people doing this work don't have, right?
No,
so it's difficult to understand how to interpret things with a lens and view of the world that way. You know what I mean?
They would say these guys have drank the Kool-Aid.
Which is, I think that's why it's important for people to get out and just travel, just to speak to non-archaeologists listening to this, just to understand the world around you in a little bit better way. You do that better by experiencing other cultures. I literally just got back from Mexico. It's our fourth year going down there. Was there 6 weeks this time around? And you have to understand things like Mexico time and things like, you know, how things work at a restaurant and how things work at the grocery store. It's just different and you can't put your bias on it. We see plenty of people, Americans and Canadians, that come down and they just get all hot and bothered with somebody because they're not behaving in a way that they expect. This isn't Canada and this isn't the United States. This is Mexico. So you have to behave the way they behave and expect and the things that they are.
They call us the ugly Americans, right?
Exactly. Right. So
I've seen that in action. Even people who consider themselves anthropologists, archaeologists, whatever, they have this cultural ethos that they expect people to understand and timely bring them what they ask for and blah, blah, blah. And it just doesn't work that way. It's not conventional. As you say, you have Mexican time and you got other ways of thinking and doing. And it harkens back to maybe the indigenous past. The Mexica, the Mexicans were created by the connection of the Spanish with native people. And so often when you see their ceremonies, their religious activities, they're a combination of both Native American and Catholic theology, which is amazing to think of. And I have not seen a lot of that, but some I have. Some I have, and I've begun to understand a little bit about it. Even here in Bakersfield, there was a parade of Mexican people, and they were celebrating the Virgin of Guadalupe, you know, the Mother Mary, and they all paraded down to this facility where they, of course, all got drunk with drinking all kinds of things. But they had a mountain of food and a statue of Mary where they went to. That was the shrine, right?
Yeah.
So what's that all about? What's that all about?
You're right. I don't know. It's just phenomenal the way that happens, to be honest with you. So yeah,
it's about abundance, the mothering. When I see the Mexican people here in Bakersfield, when they have that date for the feast of Mother Mary, the Virgin of Guadalupe, it is crazy wild. They have enormous amounts of flowers covering the Virgin of Guadalupe image, and then they get up at 4 a.m. and have this music and dance and celebration, and all of this And then they have this passion with Mother Mary and the Virgin of Guadalupe. When I was there in Mexico City and went to the shrine, went to the Basilica, I went to a museum. Yeah. And in that museum is the Museo de Milagros. It was the Museum of Miracles. I said, I got to see that one.
Right.
So you walk in, right? On the right-hand side, there's all kinds of tin, pictures of tin all over from the top to the bottom. All of those represent a miracle that they believe was fostered by prayer to the Virgin Mary. And on the other side is all of these little ornaments. They're either silver or gold, which shows how through prayer, miracles have happened. Heals their eye, here's their legs, here's their back, whatever. All these different pieces of human physiology arrayed on this enormous representation in terms of the Milagros, the miracles.
Yeah.
And that's pretty amazing.
That is pretty amazing, honestly. Again, how do we bring this all back? How are you updating your book, basically? You had 50 pages of review. Let's bring this all back full circle.
Yeah, right.
How are you going to deal with this? How can anthropologist?
First I have to make sure I change all the names of the Indians to their self-referential. So that one's easy. But the next thing I've got to somehow do is emphasize the attributes of these super mundane beings and not the classic elements, putting them in boxes. I can't call them, you know, these are not goddesses. These are not gods. They're not deities. They're not super mundane beings. They are representations of the entanglements of this cosmic relationship.
Yeah.
And only if you think about it in those terms can you possibly give reference to and validity to what an indigenous cosmological perspective would be about the nature of these rock art beings consistently represented as avian humans, females that are intertwined with snakes. Tell me what that all means, Professor.
Yeah.
Right?
Hard to say.
But I spent the better part of between 2 and 4 years with my colleague, and we traced the Uto-Aztecan theology using the serpent as the central being and ended up publishing a book that's 70,000 words and has who knows how many pictures in it and tries to grapple with that very concept as to how to understand what a serpent image is to these native people and how it morphs and transforms into various matters and has the ability when you see it and touch it and live with it. It's a death metaphor, but a life metaphor. It has all of these binary elements to it. It has to do with rain and also has to do with the ability of producing largesse. So just this one physical entity has so much power and meaning and variety to it that you have to grapple with trying to better understand that.
Wow. Yeah. That's a big task.
Yeah, but it's doable. It's definitely doable. I think you have to dismantle your structure of knowing and remember that we're Euro-Americans, we're people that have conventional ways of thinking, put things in boxes, and scientists. But you've got to pair that also, bringing in the other levels of native thought and native perspective and native visions to justify and really bring it to the fore so that both sides of the coin can appreciate the images and the beauty of what this all represents.
It's just a final thought for myself on this. Like you said, we like to, as people in general, not just archaeologists, but we like to put things into boxes, right? So we can understand them. And we have to have the right box with the right size and say, okay, you fit here now. And even when we have this perspective and we gain this from other people, like you're discussing in this episode, sometimes that just means our box either got a little bigger or we got a few more boxes, right? But we're still trying to put things into boxes. And it just made me think about like culture and society as a whole in that, you know, the further back you go in time, the more boxes there are. But the closer you get to now, the fewer boxes there are. And there's still quite a few boxes in the world that we can put people into culturally. But I'll tell you what, the more homogenous our entertainment and the internet and the just the global shared perspective gets, the fewer boxes there are. And I don't know if we'll ever get down to one box like they are in like sci-fi movies where the whole world is just, oh, those are Earthlings. They're in the box of you're from Earth. That's probably the extreme end of this. But it's just interesting how more we align towards each other. And then you go further in the past and people are different and more different, even across valleys, than people would be today. So,
but I think basically the one thing that there's the takeaway here is the term reciprocity. If we think about animals, if we think about people, if we think about sharing this wonderful thing we call life with others and other things, other people, other beings, then if we open our hearts and minds and souls to that idea,
yeah,
that's the kernel of what much of what this cosmological stuff of natives, I think, is telling us.
For sure. All right. With that, this has been a great episode. I know it's fun to talk about stuff like this occasionally rather than just bring on a guest or discuss a panel or something like that, because you have to have foundational knowledge, right? You have to have a foundation in some of these terms and concepts and things like that. And I hope some of the audience got something out of this. And if there's anything else you're reading in your own recreational or educational or academic research and you want us to talk about it, just send a note into the show via the website, and or Dr. Garfinkel's contact information is also on the show notes. With that, I think we can end this one here.
See you on the flip-flop, gang.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.arcpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.arcpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.